Contrary to popular wishes, we haven't all been skinned alive and sold into industrial-sized soap factories. This is episode 5 of the Tux Radar podcast. I'm Paul Hudson.
I'm Graham Morrison.
I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Mike Saunders.
And I'm Mark Shuttleworth.
And in this podcast, we're talking about... Hold on a minute, that wasn't quite right. I'm Paul Hudson.
I'm Graham Morrison.
Yes. I'm Andrew Gregory, still.
I'm Mike Saunders.
I'm still Mark Shuttleworth.
Okay, listeners, it's April the 1st, so you're probably thinking, wait a minute, Mark Shuttleworth. You don't believe he's here, do you? I know you don't. So we're going to put fake Mark Shuttleworth through a quiz to prove if he's the real Mark Shuttleworth. So, fake Mark, I'll ask you some tricky questions here. Who founded Thought Consulting in 1995?
Some South African bloke, right?
All right. And who was the first South African in space?
Some Linux geek, right?
And who said, pretty as a feature, and then made a distro brown?
Then we have to be a South African as well, wouldn't we?
Right. I think you've passed the test, so I think our listeners now believe you are Mark Shuttleworth. So in this podcast, we're going to be covering GNOME 2.26 being released. Could we have done more to capitalize on Vista's failures in the period between Windows 7 and XP? And is it a good thing to have two major competing Linux desktops? Don't forget our podcast comes out every 2 weeks, always available free, always available from tuxradar.com. where we also publish news, features, and more. So bookmark it. And don't forget, this is brought to you by Linux Format Magazine, the world's finest Linux magazine.
Oh, yeah.
Available for a fantastic price of just $99 for a year, and great prices for Australia, Canada, and the whole rest of the world. Go to tinyurl.com/podcastlxf for more information. So, GNOME 2.26 is dominating the headlines. It's out, and it's got some cool new features. Guys, what do you think?
Brazero. I don't know how you pronounce it. How do you pronounce the new disk burning software?
Well, hasn't that been around for a while?
Yeah, it has, but it's only just been included in GNOME, I believe, so...
And it's got some killer new features, too.
Like what?
A new GUI.
Oh, right.
I think more buttons to click, too.
Oh, that's good. I mean, they need to catch up with K3B, possibly.
What, just by adding buttons?
Yeah.
That's not a very gnomish way of thinking, is it, really?
So we've got a bit of a plant over here.
Yeah, I think it's got like an auto DVD maker, auto CD maker, like audio CDs and stuff, built into the GUI as standard.
They've not done a KDE4 and completely rewritten everything, have they?
What are you trying to say?
No, I think the GNOME guys are still very strict about the incremental approach. But it is interesting how there's a bit of a groundswell around a kind of generational change that's coming down the pike with GNOME 3 as well. So I wonder if there's anything in 2.26 which is sort of preliminary to that.
You say GNOME. Yeah, none of us do, we?
I say GNOME.
I didn't until he bullied me out of it.
Oh, sorry.
Don't quote me on anything. I quote myself on myself, but no one else should quote.
Okay. Well, also, Evolution can now support Outlook PST files, which is the personal data files that Outlook generates that are really big and nasty.
And MAPI. What's MAPI?
Messaging Application Protocol Interface.
Sounds about right.
Sounds Microsofty enough. Maybe it's Microsoft Application Program Interface. But it means it can talk to Exchange directly rather than going through the old Outlook web access stuff.
Well, the PST thing means you can bring in all your email from Outlook and just carry on.
Yeah, I'm sure that's just how it works too.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's just that easy. DLNA? Digital Living Room Network?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's like who you UPnP, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's in Media Player now.
So presumably it'll work with your Xbox and your PS3. You'll just be able to play movies and music off your Linux box.
Yeah, again, I'm sure it just works.
Well, it's GNOME.
Yeah. But again, it's a regular, stable, incremental improvement that gets somewhere over time. Every 6 months, little tweaks here and there. And it seems to be working so far, I think, at least compared to KDE4. Would you concur with that last part particularly?
That's fine.
Moving on, of course, Google is edging forward to Chrome on Linux. Chromium now is starting to work in, amazingly enough, the Ubuntu PPAs.
Yeah, isn't that incredible?
Yeah, it is incredible. Yeah, you can get Chromium today, can't you, I think?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. There's an experimental build available.
Yeah, it's got a big stop sign saying, don't use me, don't blog me, don't write a review about me.
Which means everybody's using
it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's asking for trouble, really, isn't it?
Don't mention it on a podcast or anything.
Yeah, we didn't try it. Well, I got it from the PPA last week, and it was a big blank window. It did nothing at all. But yesterday I updated it, and it works. So they are getting somewhere. Things are happening, which is good. They're making progress. And of course, it's completely kick-ass, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's a great browser. It's a brilliant browser.
Have you been using it?
Yes.
Have you been using it with the offline stuff, like Google Docs offline?
No, I haven't tried it, no.
Gmail offline? That's where it gets really interesting for me, is where we start sort of blurring the lines completely between desktop applications and browser applications.
And yeah.
Chrome seems very strongly aimed at at making it easier and easier to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
So platform independent then?
Yeah, it's a platform independent, but still with some of the advantages of being the platform, right? Like the offline access and things like that. So it's going to be very interesting to see how that battle shapes up. You've got Chrome as a browser with some offline features, and you've got Air from Adobe. Mm. It's going to be very interesting.
But isn't one of the features of Chrome the ability to make desktop shortcuts for common things like Gmail and Google Docs?
Yeah.
But that's not a very Ubuntu way to do it, is it? We don't like desktop icons. We prefer menu items and stuff.
Well, so you could make a menu item for something like that. And it's a really interesting idea. Should we, you know, would it be reasonable for us to ship Ubuntu with Gmail as a first-class citizen, right? If it had an online, offline capability? And no doubt we'll have to resolve some of the questions there. You know, is that proprietary? How does that
Well, didn't Richard Stallman write about that recently? JavaScript web apps being very closed. Yeah. You can't get the data, which is fairly obvious if you think about it, really. You can get a source code. Have you tried Google Chrome experiments, by the way? The wacky JavaScript
everything
tricks?
Crazy you can do in JavScript.
Yeah. It's amazing what video they can do.
It's massively cool.
The Amiga Workbench emulator.
I think everyone's favorite. Yeah.
That was really nostalgic.
I like the pretty horse running through the fields.
The animated horse where you switch between tabs.
It's brilliant.
Well, one of the keys for me is actually that Chrome is making the rest of the browser market catch up, I think. Firefox 3.1/3.5. apparently is with TraceMonkey a great deal faster, which I think is fantastic. People are starting to compete in that performance.
Safari 4,
I think it is, and IE8, they've all put a lot of work into how can we make the web faster.
The JavaScript engines, yeah.
Nothing like a bit of competition. Mm. Maybe we'll return to that meme later.
Well, we did a benchmark recently about JavaScript performance on Firefox Linux, Firefox Windows, and it didn't come out too well for Linux. And some guys are saying, hey, it doesn't matter to me, you know, 1/10 of a second versus 1/100 of a second is irrelevant. But I think what Chrome and the Chrome experience are showing us is that actually, when you get something really, really fast, you can start throwing a heck of a lot more code at it and doing some really, really cool stuff once JavaScript becomes basically instant.
Absolutely, yeah.
Especially with Google behind it. You just have to take notice.
Yeah, Google's great, isn't it?
Well, I mean, in terms of competition, you have to. Especially Mozilla Foundation.
Yeah, well, didn't Mitchell Baker write about that?
Some sort of thing.
What would life be like without Google behind us?
They're reconsidering their Google search bar in Firefox by default, up to the highest bidder.
Why reconsidering it?
I would imagine, I don't know, but I'm imagining they're just throwing the idea out and seeing what happens.
Well, it was life without Google. Is it, consider it, think about it. If they're going to start competing with their own browser and they don't necessarily want to support us quite as much anymore, what's the next step? Which makes sense. You've got to think about it, haven't you? At least plan it out.
Moving on to the next section, which is Hot Topic. Our subject for this episode is, could the Linux community have done more to capitalize on the weakness of Windows Vista? And how can we prepare ourselves for the release of Windows 7, which seems to be garnering a lot of praise from Mark Shuttleworth.
Oh, wondered if that would come back to haunt me. Yeah, I don't know if you've taken a look at Windows 7, but I think it's a classy piece of work. There's clear evidence that they have, you know, recognized that they can't be slow coaches. They can't take for granted their dominance. Partly that recognition comes because of the success of Apple, but I think partly it also comes because of the tremendous inroads that we saw Linux making into the netbook market, you know, in the early stages of Vista's launch. So it's nice to have competition. Competition's good for JavaScript. Competition's good for operating systems.
Do you think we could have done more to capitalize on people not upgrading to Vista, and maybe jumping a generation of Windows?
So a phrase like that, I think you have to answer, you know, yes. Could somebody always do more? You know, could I have done more exercise? Yeah. Could I have, you know? Yes, one could always have done more. But it is, you know, it's worth, I think, taking a moment to celebrate Linux's successes in the last year. You know, we've seen John Dvorak recently coming out and saying, hey, Linux is actually not a bad desktop, which is an extraordinary...
That's a miracle, isn't
it? It's an extraordinary sort of shift. People are no longer thinking of sort of Windows as an inevitability, except for odd folks. There has been a sea change, and sort of rather than questioning, you know, if we could have done more in the past, I think we've got to keep our eyes totally laser focused on the next sort of 2 years.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's easy with hindsight to say that we could have done more, but nobody really realized this is how it's going to pan out with Vista, that people would, so many people would perhaps jump a generation of Windows and now wait for Windows 7.
Well, we all remember when Firefox got a load of people together to donate money to get an advert in the New York Times,
didn't they?
They got, I think it was a full two-page advert because people were so sick of Internet Explorer. And they wanted to get this message out. So I wonder if that's something the Linux community could have done. We could have all pitched together and got a single message out saying, if you are sick of Vista, not just amongst computer magazines, not just amongst fellow geeks.
But finish that sentence there. If you're sick on Vista, then adopt a GNOME desktop. Or if you're sick of Vista, then... And that's where it gets really challenging. This is where one of the areas where I think sort of Mozilla is different to the whole open source community when you're looking at operating systems. You know, we are much more divided and fragmented than the Firefox community is. There's the message, if you're sick of Vista, then switch to free and open source software, doesn't tell people sort of definitively what to do.
Right. I guess like saying switch to Linux, and then they go and find out and say which Linux.
Right. It gets more complex. Mm. Mm.
I guess the Mozilla Foundation is a foundation where the Linux community is a community.
Right, and Firefox is a product, whereas Linux is everything from an ideology through to a vast number of different products. But in principle, again, coming back to our successes, right?
Yeah,
Linux
yeah.
is a serious candidate on consumer PC hardware in big chunks of the world and across big slices of the PC market. We're having a profound effect on strategic discussions between the world's biggest technology companies. Whether we can translate that into a really important seat at the table of the future of technology, that remains still to be seen.
So you think we should carry on doing what we're doing and change will come?
Yes, but I wouldn't want that to imply that I think we can't improve at some things.
Right, yeah.
But fundamentally, you know, have we lost a battle now that Windows 7 is coming out? Absolutely not, you know. There's some really interesting questions, right? What is Microsoft going to do about the pricing of Windows 7?
Yeah.
Right now they can afford. Yeah, they can give XP away because they know that Vista isn't a candidate, period. But what are they going to do with Windows 7? On the one hand, they're saying, you know, Windows 7 will run on any netbook.
Yeah.
And if that's true, the question is, you know, are they going to expect people to pay $60, $70 for it? Or are they going to fragment their own market by netbook versus PC? It's just going to be a very interesting time. And I think Linux is going to be a key force in the battle.
Now, it seems to me that if Microsoft gets their act together, they can get Windows 7 out fairly quickly. But it's still going to be at least two Ubuntu or Linux releases away. To what extent are you saying, would you say that Windows 7 is a source of inspiration for ideas? I mean, some might say, for example, that if you look at the notifications in Jaunty, you say, well, that's actually a bit OS X-y, like the Growl framework. And you look at Windows 7 saying, actually, some of these ideas, we can take these for a change.
Well, I think, you know, I think it's smart to stand on the shoulders of giants. I think it's smart to look around and look for good ideas. Mm. And, you know, as I've said publicly, I think there are good ideas in Windows 7. So, yeah, to the extent that those fit naturally into a Linux desktop environment, we should embrace them. The Windows guys are certainly learning from us, you know. The Windows install experience, the Windows 7 install experience, looks a hell of a lot more like an Ubuntu install experience than any previous version of Windows ever did, you know. No one should be, you know, embarrassed or ashamed to say, you look around at the competition and you find the best ideas and then you innovate on top of that and try and push the limits of what's possible. We should play to our strengths, but we also shouldn't get left behind just because, you know, we're too proud to adopt a good idea from somewhere else.
So we're now halfway through the podcast, folks. Still to come, the discovery of the week, and of course, the open ballot. Is it a good thing for Linux to have two major competing desktop environments?
Now, discovery of the week, where we talk about cool stuff we've discovered in the last 7 days. And for a change, do you want to start, Andrew?
I'd love to.
No.
If you've been reading the magazine, you'll know that I've spotted my tutorials about the Acer Aspire 1. In the latest one, which has yet to go on sale, I installed Ubuntu Netbook Remix, and it's an absolute breath of fresh air. Thanks very much.
Yeah, cheers, Mark.
Glad it's working out.
It's just
Is this the jaunty? Is this a sort of a daily build of jaunty?
It's the daily build one, yeah. Okay, fantastic. From about 2 weeks ago. And it's completely different to Olympus. Olympus, I don't know why, it seems to be really unstable. And also it felt really restrictive with the sort of big blocky menu things. You know, you got the impression that there was a proper Linux distro under there, but I had no way of how to get it out. You had to go into config files and change and get it back to an XFCE desktop. But no, not with Ubuntu. It's just you install it and it's there, and it doesn't look intimidating or anything. It's the unknown Ubuntu developers have they've obviously cut it down a little bit to fit the screen resolution, but it's a full distro.
Yeah, the Netbook Remix is such a fun project because you have this wonderful discipline of vertical resolution to work under, right? So it's always interesting when you're working under a constraint. You say, okay, what's really, really important? And when you say like vertical screen pixels are more precious than anything else, then you come up with really interesting ideas, and that project seems to have really worked out well. So I'm glad it's working for you.
It is the most beautiful one so far, isn't it? It looks really good straight away.
It's not brown, is it?
I'm afraid it's brown. It's more marbly brown, though, isn't it? I think
it's higher contrast, isn't it?
I think you're trying to find some word for classy brown.
Yeah, it wasn't in the papers today, this Netbook Remix.
It was mentioned, yes.
Seriously?
For all you foreign readers, in the Independent newspaper today in the UK, it's in there. They got a Shiba Netbook and had, I think, three random folks.
How cool
using
is that?
Netbook Remix.
I had no idea. Right next to a picture of a guy with a guitar. We're kind of almost getting into the cool pages. Yeah. this is dangerous.
In 5 years' time, that'll be Sting rather than some guy.
It is a pink guitar.
Amy Winehouse, you know, wouldn't let go of Ubuntu for anything.
There we go. Right, moving around clockwise this time, as everybody can see. my discovery of the week is a game again, and it's called Donkey Belonky. This game was written in 3 days for the Speed Hack competition. It's a clone of Rat Poker from Alexey Pahitsnov, who is the guy who created Tetris. Jeez. I'm not sure if I pronounced his name correctly. Basically, different coloured donkeys move around on a board, and you operate a bubble in which you can trap them. And if you trap a donkey, other donkeys move round, and when three donkeys of the same colour bunch together, they explode. But it all in a very kind of comical type of way, and not
exploding donkeys
gory.
Comical.
Yes, it is. In a cartoony type of fashion. So
when you have to clean the screen of donkeys.
Effectively, yes. Yeah, it's donkey side. but it's very simple, but it's very addictive, just as you'd expect from the creator of Tetris.
Is it inspired by a religious festival in rural Spain?
I don't know.
It sounds more like inspired by Jeff Minter, if you ask me.
Yeah. It does in a way, doesn't it? These animals. So that's my discovery, Mark.
Spent 2 weeks finding that.
Yep. I've been very busy.
Yeah.
So my discovery of the week is discovery of the morning, actually, is something called CouchDB, which is an I think it's an Apache project. It's like a little non-relational database, like a local sort of data store, but it's really good at replicating. So since we live in this increasingly connected world where I want the same data on my phone and the same data on my netbook and the same data on my PC, mm-hmm. this seems like a really useful kind of substrate, something that can easily allow you to have, you know, the same bookmarks everywhere, the same contacts everywhere, the same to-do lists and things like that. So just a nice, useful, classy little piece of technology.
Is it, what, an alpha stage one planning or a...
No, it's got a thriving community around it. There are some big companies that have started working with it. You know, I wouldn't say it's kind of hit that that golden sort of level of maturity, but it certainly has all the hallmarks of something to watch.
It sounds like some sort of distributed SQL Lite or something.
Yeah, that's a great way to describe it. Yeah.
There you go. It's like I'm a journalist.
You kind of do this. Yeah, exactly. You've got a gift for language or something. You should do something with that.
Yeah. Okay, so is it me?
Yeah, Paul.
I think I'm next to the table. Mine is yet another Mono application. I'm going to get crucified for this.
Oh, great.
Bare FTP, BARE, as opposed to the animal. Bare FTP. It supports FTP, FTPS, SSH FTP, or SFTP, I guess. All in one, all modified, using, I think, MonoTorrent library.
Right.
It's very fast, multi-threaded. It is, of course, nowhere near as good as GFTP. but that's almost certainly not going to stop it getting into SUSE.
Or NCFTP.
No, just FTP.
Well, no, I was noticing, I installed, sorry, Mark, I installed OpenSUSE 11.1 recently. Just to try it out, I fiddle, you know.
Why would you do that?
And I noticed that they've put Monsoon on there, which is a very, very immature BitTorrent client, which is clearly not as good as Transmission, but it's written using Mono. And I'm wondering how many of their choices are driven by Mono and how many are driven by functionality.
Does the ls command, is that written in Mono yet? Shut down. Glibsy.
It's all coming, I'm sure. But you know, so you know, bare FTP has got a lot of prospects behind it. To be fair, gFTP isn't exactly developing at lightning speed anymore. In fact, I think it's pretty much unloved right now. So it's good to see some sort of work taking place on something else.
So with Mono, if you install something like a single application like Monsoon, does that mean that you also make that sort of capability available to all sorts of other applications? I mean, could there be a reason why they're driving it that goes that's deeper than just the simple, you know, user experience that you have there? Is it because putting it there creates a capability that other apps in Mono can take advantage of?
Well, obviously with Mono, you're loading its own XML libraries, you're loading its own networking libraries and stuff like that, loads them all up. So the first hit you get from loading Mono is painful. But once it's up, it's basically free to have other Mono applications. So it's not terrible, but you know, if you had Transmission, I think it's GTK anyway, isn't it?
Transmission. Yes, it is.
So that's already loaded anyway, so it's also the same difference. And it, you know, when I installed it, and then vanilla SUSE 11.1, this is a real winch to the SUSE developers, sorry. I installed it, I pressed maximize in the Monsoon window, and it crashed. Maximizing the window made it crash, which was just dreadful. I mean, come on, guys.
There's a lesson learned.
Test it before it goes out the door.
Maybe they've just got huge screens and they never need to maximize.
Anyway, BareFTP doesn't do that. It doesn't crash. It's very good, and it's only at 0.21, I think, right now. So there's time yet, and I think it should be good.
There we go.
It's going in the right direction.
BareFTP. Graham, your music app is...
I've only done two music apps. Two music apps. And this has nothing to do with music. It's just a small extension to OpenOffice called OpenOffice to Google Docs.
Uh-huh.
The clue is,
all right,
what does that do? Yeah. But it's been around for a few years, since 2007, but I only came across it this week, and it really does just, you can save directly from within OpenOffice to your Google Docs account, and because it's ODT, you can open up your files in Google Docs if you need to, or load them again into OpenOffice from another desktop using this extension, and it's very useful.
There's a 003, I guess. But
yeah, 003. Yeah, if you don't want to use Google Docs in your browser, you can use OpenOffice and get the best of both worlds.
I'm sure there was some talk a while back about Google doing some sort of online storage space.
Yeah.
If they did that, there could be like a GVFS mount, couldn't it?
Yeah,
you could just save directly to anywhere in any program.
That'd be nice, and then Google Docs would see the files on that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's like the sort of Duke Nukem forever of Google services now.
It is, yeah. It'll come before Duke Nukem, though, I think.
This podcast revisits the oldest flame war of all time, apart from the endless Empire versus Federation debate. It's two desktop environments under Linux, the two biggies that is at least, KDE and GNOME, and we wanted to know, is it a good thing that we've got two big desktops competing with each other? Should choice trump all of the considerations, or is it, you know, is it just great that we've got competition, or are we duplicating effort? What do you think, Mark?
I like competition. I really do. I think it's important, and I think without it, we would be, you know, we'd be worse off. I think we could be smart about how we create that competition. We could work hard. We should work hard to make sure that, like, an ISV like Skype or Adobe doesn't basically have to do things twice in order to have done Linux, right? So we should really figure that out. That's very important and increasingly important. But that still leaves, to my mind, that still leaves room for having, you know, both GNOME and KDE, and so I guess I would come down on the side of being in favor of the competition and being supportive of both environments and the innovation that drives.
Well, I'm not in favor of it. I do like choice, and I think the choice between GNOME and KDE really comes down to how the developer wants to work, because you choose the API that's more convenient and you know better. But I do think it's a lot of wasted effort and it's confusing. What I would like to see is both GNOME and KDE coexisting, but on a single unified desktop, so that programmers still have the same choice and we still have the same breadth of applications, but we can present a single front to new users especially.
Couldn't we just edge towards that slowly with things like Dbus, so that when you click File, Save, Dbus says, okay, now open a File Selector dialog, which looks the same whether it's KDE or GNOME. And
yeah, but why do we have to have the distinct two distinctly different desktops? Why can't we just have a unified panel and a unified set of menus and a way of communicating to the desktop, and then KDE and GNOME GTK APIs can do whatever they want?
Because if we had it unified, I'd be using KDE 4 right now. I'd hate myself.
Well, if you wanted to use Copy, you could.
The KDE guys have done an incredible job. If you look at 4.2, it's it's a very different beast. And the GNOME guys, so the KDE guys have been banging on this idea of how do you make a major jump, and the GNOME guys have been figuring out the incremental releases. Now I think they're both turning it around. If you talk to the KDE community, they've started embracing the idea of incremental releases for this stable stretch, and the GNOME guys are saying, well, how do we figure out how to make a major jump? So I don't think it's helpful to criticize KDE for doing KDE 4. I think there's some fantastic work that's gone into that. If you go back to the original sort of divide, it was really a licensing issue. It was the LGPL, the fact that Qt wasn't LGPL. Now it is.
Yeah.
And so I'm surprised we haven't seen more debate and discussion about what that could mean in the Linux environment.
Bringing the two closer together.
Yeah, absolutely. And finding ways to make it easier for ISVs and users to kind of get the best possible experience while still leaving the foundations of competition in place.
Isn't the flip side of that most users don't really care what the LGPL is, don't care that it's Qt or Qt? I can't say Qt. It's Qt. Qt, GTK, da-da-da. All they care about is, hey, I've got my KDE 4.2 and my Amarok doesn't support my iPod anymore. They worked fine at 3.5, they broke it. I'm sure a lot of work went into breaking it, but they still broke it.
Right. Yeah, end users don't care. But developers really, really, really do care about licensing.
Oh yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah. So that was a reasonable basis for the delta, for a long time. It'd be really interesting. We have, for the first time ever, we have a joint summit between the two of them in Gran Canaria in, I think, July.
Sounds nice.
And, yeah, we should go to
Yeah, who's going then?
The desktop summit.
Convenient translation.
It's hard to speculate what might come out of that, but if it rocks the way it might rock, this scene could change very quickly.
Mm. Yeah, they are certainly getting closer as desktops in terms of licensing and what they're after.
Well, I think Remixer 96 from tuxradio.com sums it up great when he says, yes, it's great that we have two competing desktops, if for no other reason than that it creates unending drama and debate between those with different software philosophies. Really, he thinks it's rather charming that the community can talk and hash out the differences between an ambitious vision and steady incrementalism, all while trying out both programs on exactly the same machine. Not an anonymous penguin says, open source, forking inevitable. LinuxGirl13, also from tuxradio.com, made the point that rather than it being confusing for new users that we've got two different desktops, she thinks that it's good because KDE is more like Windows and GNOME is more like the Mac interface. So it means that Linux is just as welcoming to people whichever proprietary OS they're coming from. I don't know, any thoughts about that?
I think probably Steve Jobs would disagree about it. It's more like a Mac. No, one of the comments that actually stood out to me was from an anonymous penguin, and she said, it's not long before GNOME becomes dependent on Mono, at which point I'll be dropping it and moving to KDE like a shot. If I wanted MS crapware in my box, I'd just run Windows.
Oh,
thanks for that. And that brings us to the end of our podcast. Fortunately for all of us.
Hang on a sec. You've forgotten again. It's one more thing.
Well, actually, no. This time, I've got one more thing for you this time.
One more thing for me? Yes, why for me? What have I done?
Last time, you told everyone that raising skinny elephants is utterly boring.
It was indeed,
and we had some complaints. People were saying, no, it's raising elephants is so utterly boring. Different letters, you see. Organization.
Same letters, different order. You know, that guy's obviously trying to sync his disk at a different time, but...
less efficient, is it?
It's wrong. It's definitely wrong, yeah. Skinny, boring elephants. That's Mars better, surely. Okay. Everybody please tell us which you prefer.
I'll let you carry on with your
But my
then.
This one more thing is a data integrity thing. Now, with pretty much every operating system, when you save a file, it doesn't actually get saved to the drive immediately. The operating system builds together multiple file writes before writing it to the drive for performance reasons. So, if you're sitting in your house in a thunderstorm, if you're really worried about your data, think the power could go off at any moment, when you save a file, open a terminal and enter sync, S-Y-N-C, You'll see your drive light flash and you will know that the data is there on your disk. And if you're ultra paranoid like me, you can use your window manager to set a key binding to sync. So whenever I save a file, I hit Control Alt and S and I know my data's there.
That is paranoid.
That's great, that is.
That's fantastic, yeah. And with that, we come to the real end of our podcast, episode 5. Don't forget our awesome subscriptions deal at tinyurl.com/podcastlxf. And also, all the notes for this podcast are on the website. Tune in 2 weeks' time. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
All right.
Right, great.
Let's blow this joint. Go home.